Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The United States, Iran, and five of the world powers say they've reached an understanding that will direct them toward achieving a comprehensive nuclear agreement within 3 months. Reading out a joint statement, EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini says, quote, a decisive step, end quote, has been achieved. Secretary of State John Kerry tweeted that there was a deal to resolve major issues on nuclear programs. Back to work soon on a final deal. Kenyan officials say at least 70 students are dead after al-Shabaab militants attacked a university in eastern Kenya. Kenya's Interior Minister Joseph Nakarisi says another 79 students were injured in the assault Thursday on Garissa University College, about 370 kilometers east of Nairobi. He said 500 have been rescued, which would leave about 160 students unaccounted for. He said operations to clear out the attackers and find more students continue. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. Yemeni officials say Shiite Houthi rebels and their allies fought their way through the center of Aden Thursday and seized the presidential palace in the key southern port city. The rebels have been driving deeper into Aden in recent days while battling forces loyal to internationally backed President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, who fled Aden last week. The capture of Aden, the last remaining stronghold of those backing Mr. Hadi, would mark a setback for the Saudi-led coalition, which has been carrying out airstrikes for more than a week across Yemen. At a news conference in the Saudi capital, Riyadh, a Saudi defense official said he believes the situation in the city is relatively stable and calm. This is VOA News. A suicide bomber killed at least 17 people and wounded 50 others in Afghanistan's Eastern Coast province Thursday. Spokesman for the provincial governor told VOA that the bomber struck a rally being staged against alleged corrupt practices of the provincial government. A spokesman for the Taliban has said it has nothing to do with the Coast blast. At least 56 people are dead after a Russian trawler sank in the Sea of Okhotsk in Russia's Far East Wednesday. Emergency officials said 63 of 132 of the crew members on board the ship were rescued after the Dalny Vostok sank in icy waters near Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula. 13 people are still missing. Officials said that the ship sank in about 15 minutes and did not send a distress signal. The most seriously injured were being airlifted to the city of Magadan, about 250 kilometers to the north. At least 14 local fishing vessels and some 1,300 people were involved in the rescue operation, emergency services said. China's internet regulator has slammed Google for deciding to not recognize the agency's website safety checks following a security breach blamed on Beijing. The China Internet Network Information Center improperly certified false credentials for several Google domains, according to a blog post by the U.S.-based web giant. Those who visited the affected websites were vulnerable to so-called man-in-the-middle hacking attempts, which can be used to steal data and impersonate unsuspecting web users. Google's decision to no longer recognize the agency's safety verification process means those using Google Chrome, the world's most popular web browser, could receive a security warning when trying to visit websites approved by the China Internet Network Information Center. And U.S. televangelist Robert Shuler, who beamed his upbeat Christian messages on faith and personal success around the world to millions of people, died Thursday at 88. At his peak in the 1990s, Shuler's Hour of Power telecast had 20 million viewers in 180 countries. And again, the United States, Iran, and five other world powers say they've reached an understanding that will direct them toward achieving a comprehensive nuclear agreement within 3 months. Late word from the White House is that President Barack Obama will speak to the nation from the Rose Garden within the hour to provide more information about this. More on VOA News as details become available. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
It started in the classes and we were in the hostel sleeping. So when we had the bullets, we just moved out of the hostel and ran to the field.
That's Garissa University College student Mercy Chebet describing an attack by Al-Shabaab on her school. We'll have details next. Also in the news, Egyptian government officials say armed gunmen attacked military checkpoints in the volatile Sinai Peninsula. And Nigeria remains calm after the official announcement yesterday of the winner of the presidential elections. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack on a university in Garissa in northeastern Kenya that has killed at least 70 people and injured 79 others. Police say the gunman had stormed the campus and opened fire indiscriminately. Witnesses reported seeing four or five attackers on campus. Some said they were asking students whether they are Christian or Muslim. Student Mercy Chebet told VOA she and other students evacuated the dormitories as the gunman approached. It started in the classes, she said, and we were in the hostels sleeping. So when we heard the bullets, we just moved out of the hostels and ran to the field. She said the soldiers went to the hostels where they had previously been and began shooting. And another student, Beatrice Mathai, says that, quote, it was past midnight at 4:30 a.m. local time when the gunmen stormed us. At first, we were told that gunmen seized the university, but later we heard the heavy exchange gunfire. We ran from where we were, kneeled down, and looked out towards the football club. Finally, we jumped over the building's wall. Before the attack, we were 29 students. Now we are seven. We are very frightened and we don't even know where we are. And that's the end of quote of Beatrice Mathai. Well, Kenya's Red Cross said 65 casualties were taken to a local hospital, most with gunshot wounds. It says five of the wounded were airlifted to Nairobi for treatment. The Kenyan Interior Ministry said on Twitter that two assailants have been killed and security forces have intensified a rescue operation. In a televised statement, President Uhuru Kenyatta said police and the Interior Ministry are coordinating the government response to the attack and have asked for the public's cooperation.
The full details of casualties will be communicated in due course by the Cabinet Secretary for Interior and Coordination of National Government, who is coordinating operations with the Inspector General of Police in Garissa. On my own behalf, on behalf of my government, I extend condolences to the families of those who have perished in this attack. We continue to pray for the quick recovery of the injured and the safe rescue of those still being held hostage. I also assure the nation that my government has undertaken appropriate deployment to the affected area and is fully seized of the situation. I also take this opportunity to urge Kenyans to stay calm as we resolve this matter and to provide the authorities with any information they may have in connection with any threats to our security. This is a moment for everyone throughout the country to be vigilant as we confront and defeat our enemies. I also further direct the Inspector General of Police to take urgent steps and ensure that the 10,000 recruits whose enrollment is pending promptly report for training at the Kenya Police College in Kiganjo. I take full responsibility for this directive. We as a country have suffered unnecessarily due to shortage of security personnel. Kenya badly needs additional officers, and I will not keep the nation waiting.
The U.S. ambassador to Kenya, Robert Goddick, also prepared a statement condemning what he called Al-Shabaab's heinous terrorist attack. He says, and quote, the United States strongly condemns Al-Shabaab's heinous terrorist attack today at Garissa University College, which has resulted in the deaths and injuries of many Kenyans. We extend our deepest condolences to all who have been affected. We also offer our profound appreciation and gratitude to the members of the Kenyan security services who are risking their lives to end this cowardly act. The attack once again reinforces the need for all countries and communities to unite in the effort to combat violent extremism. The United States remains a committed friend of Kenya. We stand shoulder to shoulder with the government and the people of Kenya in the effort to end the scourge of terrorism. End of quote. Well, last week, the University of Nairobi issued a warning to its students that Kenyan government agencies had intelligence reports indicating Al-Shabaab was planning an attack on a major university, among other targets. Garissa is located about 370 kilometers east of Nairobi. Al-Shabaab is known for assaults on large buildings such as the Westgate Mall in Nairobi in 2013 and Somalia's presidential palace, which it attacked twice last year. The Westgate attack killed more than 60 civilians. Well, we're going live now for an update on the situation to VOA's Gabe Joslow, who is live in Nairobi. Thanks for joining us, Gabe.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Gabe, what is the latest information you have now?
Well, the latest that we've heard was the most recent announcement from the Interior Secretary, who confirmed that at least 70 people have been killed in this attack. 79 more injured. And he made it clear that the operations were still ongoing through the night, which means that we could possibly see that death toll rise. Earlier in the day, we heard that there were hundreds of students who were possibly still stuck inside the university during the attack. Most of them have been accounted for, but there are still many who have not. So we are waiting for word on their identities and their whereabouts.
Did the university have an early warning that there could be an attack at the school?
That's unclear. As you had mentioned before, the University of Nairobi certainly had a warning that they issued last week to their students. There's reason to believe that other universities had access to that information as well. I spoke to a couple of students at Garissa University, the one that came under attack, and one person told me that they had heard of such a warning, but they hadn't seen it themselves. So it's not clear that their students were warned of any danger.
The information that we have also regarding security is that there were only two security guards on campus. Is that correct?
Well, we know that two security guards were killed in the attack. I believe there were others on campus. Garissa town is also close to a lot of Kenyan military installations. So the Kenyan military and the police were very quick to arrive on the scene. And the students who I spoke to made it seem that they rely a lot on the Kenyan forces in the area to help out with their security. So they weren't relying just on the security guards on campus.
And what is the security situation right now?
Well, right now, the Kenyan forces are continuing what they call their mopping up operations. They say they're almost finished clearing out the remaining militants. The Kenyan chief of police has also declared an overnight curfew for four counties in Kenya, including Garissa County, that will last for 2 weeks while they sort of assess the situation and assess existing terror threats. You know, Kenya, especially along the border with Somalia, have experienced a lot of attacks over recent years, and it's a major priority for the government to try to do something about it.
Okay, thanks so much, Gabe, for this news and for the updates you have given us. And that's VOA's Gabe Joslow in Nairobi, who spoke with us on the attack by Al-Shabaab on Garissa University. Minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Egyptian government officials say 17 people died today in multiple attacks by armed gunmen against military checkpoints in the volatile Sinai Peninsula. Another 15 are wounded and several more may have been taken hostage when two armored vehicles were taken. The gunmen conducted four simultaneous attacks in the region that diverted attention from a major assault on a checkpoint at the town of Sheikh Zuwaid. Security sources say 15 soldiers and 2 civilians died in the latest attacks since Cairo ordered a crackdown near the Gaza border more than 1 year ago. There has been no claim of responsibility for the attacks. Well, Nigeria remains calm today after its National Electoral Commission Chairman Adehiro Jega announced yesterday the winner of the presidential elections. Retired General Muhammadu Buhari officially won the poll, getting 15.4 million votes. His main challenger, current President Goodluck Jonathan, won 12.9 million. President Jonathan's People's Democratic Party has led Nigeria since 1999. Mr. Buhari of the All Progressives Congress Party is to be inaugurated May 29th. Our colleague Peter Cloti is in Abuja. He spoke with the INEC chairman yesterday and gives us an update on what he said about the elections.
Well, Professor Ferris, the chairman of the Independent National Electoral Commission in Nigeria, expressed satisfaction with the election was conducted that he administered, despite a few challenges here and there. But he said new technology was introduced to ensure that the system or the electoral process was credible, transparent, and that met international standards. So he's looking forward to another round of election, which is the gubernatorial election, April 11th. And he says that the card reader, which was, you know, somewhat controversial, is here to stay because it sanitized and ensure transparency in Nigeria's electoral process.
Also yesterday, I know that when we spoke, you had mentioned that the PDP may formally challenge the election results. Where do they stand today with this?
Well, they are still planning. They want to challenge the results of the election in parts of the country. However, the party also expressed concern that supporters have been intimidated and harassed of the country because of the victory of General Muhammadu Buhari, who is now president-elect. So they have urged the incoming party to call on their supporters and not to attack or intimidate or harass. We're being harassed. Their cars were being prevented from moving from place to place. They were being blocked here and there. So that is the concern. And they call on the incoming party to ensure that their supporters desist from all act of violence, intimidation, or harassment.
And on the issue of violence, I understand some people did lose their lives yesterday because of this election. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. Some people lost their lives because of what some people describe as over celebration. A moment of silence was called by the president-elect after he received a certificate from the INEC chairman to those who lost their lives for over celebration, celebrating his victory. However, other opponents were also killed because of attacks on them after the electoral victory. So these are some of the challenges that the new coming president would have to address as quickly as possible.
When you say over-celebration, what exactly happened?
Well, some of them were driving cars, sitting on top of cars. While cars were moving, they would try to get off or alight from it. So those are the kinds of dangerous celebrations that they were involved in, and they lost their lives as a result of that.
What areas did this occur in?
It's all across the country, especially where supporters of the APC were.
Also, the people that were attacked, were these supporters of Buhari who were attacked and killed?
No. Supporters of the ruling or outgoing party, these are supporters of the People's Democratic Party that were doing attacks, not supporters of Buhari, no.
So at this point, what is the expectation today?
Well, the city is quiet now. Things coming to normal. I just visited a shopping center in the heart of Abuja. They call it the Gute Market. And activity is ongoing, bringing over people. Because even when I came here last week, a lot of the shops were closed because of fear of violence and among other issues. But now, calm has returned and people are going about their regular businesses here at the market.
That was VOA's Peter Cloti. He spoke with me from Abuja today. Well, Muhammadu Buhari made history in Nigeria this week by unseating incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan in a Democratic vote. Now comes the hard part, making good on the promises he made on the campaign trail. Chris Stein reports from the capital, Abuja.
Change. It was the word printed on billboards, shouted at rallies, and uttered in greeting among supporters of Mr. Buhari and his All Progressives Congress Party. And it worked. Mr. Buhari got 2.5 million votes more than Mr. Jonathan, whose campaign centered on the idea of continuing his transformation agenda. Political commentator Chris Ngwodo says the president-elect's slogan was a powerful rhetorical tool.
There was no doubt about the argument for change in terms of juxtaposing the incumbent president with the president-elect. There was no argument. Buhari certainly represents a departure from him, both in style, in substance, and in temperament as well.
Now he has to deliver. Mr. Buhari's promises include an end to the Boko Haram insurgency, which has ravaged the country's northeast in its quest to impose strict Islamic law. He also campaigned on cutting down corruption and implementing universal health care. But when he takes office in May, Chuba Ezekwesili, a research analyst at the Nigeria Economic Summit Group, says Mr. Buhari will inherit a government that is borrowing to pay its bills and still has not passed a 2015 budget. Social spending promises, like universal health care, may end up on the back burner.
I mean, the majority of our budget is in recurrent expenditure, which is essentially to say, to pay salaries. So, I mean, if we're already at the point where we're borrowing money from the World Bank to pay for the 2015 salary, then it shows that we're already in a bad situation.
Much of Mr. Buhari's campaign centered on snuffing out Boko Haram, but the militant group is perhaps at its lowest point in years. The Nigerian military, with help from foreign mercenaries and troops from neighboring countries, has over the past weeks chased the militants out of almost all of the towns they overran in the northeast. Don Demowo, a Nigeria-based analyst for Africa Practice Consultancy, says it will be up to Mr. Buhari to figure out how to put the group down for good.
So I don't know if it means creating some kind of something similar to the Niger Delta Commission to address specific issues in that part of the country or something of the sort, but something really that addresses, you know, the peculiar issues of people in that part of the country, the kind of environment that would allow that kind of radical ideology to foster and develop to the point that, you know, this group is able to take over a part of the country.
Any solution will have to address the social and economic problems fueling the insurgency, Demowo says, but cash is short. And Demowo says tackling those problems may have to wait. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Thank you, Chris. Well, Amnesty International reports that Nigeria and Egypt account for more than one-third of the death sentences announced in 55 countries in 2014. Amnesty officials in London say they are alarmed that more than 2,400 people have had death verdicts that were delivered last year, a 28% spike over 2013. Officials reported, however, that last year only 605 individuals, less than one-fourth of death sentences announced, were executed. Nigerian courts delivered more than 650 death sentences, most for murder and armed robbery. However, 54 soldiers were sentenced to death for refusal to obey orders in the fight against Boko Haram terrorists. Egypt condemned more than 500 last year. Almost half of that number were supporters of ex-president Mohamed Morsi. They were found guilty in the deaths of 11 police officers. Amnesty was not able to gather complete global data on death sentences. Numbers were not available for several countries, including North Korea and China. The Dui Hua Foundation, a U.S.-based prison research group, estimates 2,400 executions in China for 2014. Well, the recent resignation of Mozambique's former president as head of the ruling party came as a surprise. But analysts say ceding power of the party to the president could be a sign the nation is putting its troublesome past behind it. Anita Powell reports from our Southern Africa Bureau in Johannesburg.
When Mozambique held peaceful elections in October, observers and analysts hailed the vote as a turning point in the Southern African nation, known for a bloody 15-year civil war that only ended in 1992. But a top analyst says a recent political development has been, in many ways, more significant than even that critical vote. Recently, former President Armando Guebuza, who was retired by term limits, quit as leader of the ruling Frelimo party. It was a sudden end to a months-long power struggle between Mr. Guebuza and the new president, Filipe Nyusi, of the Frelimo party. Mr. Guebuza's resignation cleared the way for the only candidate for party chairman, Mr. Nyusi. The president heading the ruling party has been a tradition in Mozambique since its independence from Portugal in 1975. Africa expert Alex Vines of the London-based Chatham House Research Organization says this political realignment is a critical moment for Mozambique.
I'm just surprised international media haven't covered this in the way they should. This is highly significant for Mozambique.
Had Mr. Gabuza not stepped aside, which Vines says was at the urging of top Frelimo members, the party would have had to wait.
And we interrupt our regular programming for breaking news. The United States, Iran, and five other world powers today announced an understanding outlining limits on Iran's nuclear program so it cannot lead to atomic weapons, directing negotiators toward achieving a comprehensive agreement within 3 months. President Obama is about to address the nation from the Rose Garden, and we take you now live to the White House and President Obama.
Make our country, our allies, and our world safer. This has been a long time coming. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been advancing its nuclear program for decades. By the time I took office, Iran was operating thousands of centrifuges, which can produce the materials for a nuclear bomb. And Iran was concealing a covert nuclear facility. I made clear that we were prepared to resolve this issue diplomatically, but only if Iran came to the table in a serious way. When that did not happen, we rallied the world to impose the toughest sanctions in history, sanctions which had a profound impact on the Iranian economy. Now, sanctions alone could not stop Iran's nuclear program, but they did help bring Iran to the negotiating table. Because of our diplomatic efforts, the world stood with us. And we were joined at the negotiating table by the world's major powers, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Russia, and China, as well as the European Union. Over a year ago, we took the first step towards today's framework with a deal to stop the progress of Iran's nuclear program and roll it back in key areas. And recall that at the time, skeptics argued that Iran would cheat, and that we could not verify their compliance, and the interim agreement would fail. Instead, it has succeeded exactly as intended. Iran has met all of its obligations. It eliminated its stockpile of dangerous nuclear material. Inspections of Iran's program increased, and we continued negotiations to see if we could achieve a more comprehensive deal. Today, after many months of tough, principled diplomacy, we have achieved the framework for that deal. And it is a good deal, a deal that meets our core objectives. This framework would cut off every pathway that Iran could take to develop a nuclear weapon. Iran will face strict limitations on its program, and Iran has also agreed to the most robust and intrusive inspections and transparency regime ever negotiated for any nuclear program in history. So this deal is not based on trust. It's based on unprecedented verification. Many key details will be finalized over the next 3 months, and nothing is agreed to until everything is agreed. But here are the basic outlines of the deal that we are working to finalize. First, Iran will not be able to pursue a bomb using plutonium because it will not develop weapons-grade plutonium. The core of its reactor at Iraq will be dismantled and replaced. The spent fuel from that facility will be shipped out of Iran for the life of the reactor. Iran will not build a new heavy water reactor, and Iran will not reprocess fuel from its existing reactors, ever. Second, this deal shuts down Iran's path to a bomb using enriched uranium. Iran has agreed that its installed centrifuges will be reduced by two-thirds. Iran will no longer enrich uranium at its Fordow facility. Iran will not enrich uranium with its advanced centrifuges for at least the next 10 years. The vast majority of Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium will be neutralized. Today, estimates indicate that Iran is only 2 or 3 months away from potentially acquiring the raw materials that could be used for a single nuclear bomb. Under this deal, Iran has agreed that it will not stockpile the materials needed to build a weapon. Even if it violated the deal, for the next decade at least, Iran would be a minimum of a year away from acquiring enough material for a bomb. And the strict limitations on Iran's stockpile will last for 15 years. Third, this deal provides the best possible defense against Iran's ability to pursue a nuclear weapon covertly, that is, in secret. International inspectors will have unprecedented access not only to Iranian nuclear facilities, but to the entire supply chain that supports Iran's nuclear program, from uranium mills that provide the raw materials to the centrifuge production and storage facilities that support the program. If Iran cheats, the world will know it. If we see something suspicious, we will inspect it. Iran's past efforts to weaponize its program will be addressed. With this deal, Iran will face more inspections than any other country in the world. So this will be a long-term deal that addresses each path to a potential Iranian nuclear bomb. There will be strict limits on Iran's program for a decade. Additional restrictions on building new facilities or stockpiling materials will last for 15 years. The unprecedented transparency measures will last for 20 years or more. Indeed, some will be permanent. And as a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran will never be permitted to develop a nuclear weapon. In return for Iran's actions, the international community has agreed to provide Iran with relief from certain sanctions, our own sanctions and international sanctions imposed by the United Nations Security Council. This relief will be phased as Iran takes steps to adhere to the deal. If Iran violates the deal, sanctions can be snapped back into place. Meanwhile, other American sanctions on Iran for its support of terrorism, its human rights abuses, its ballistic missile program will continue to be fully enforced. Now, let me reemphasize, our work is not yet done. The deal has not been signed. Between now and the end of June, the negotiators will continue to work through the details of how this framework will be fully implemented, and those details matter. If there is backsliding on the part of the Iranians, if the verification and inspection mechanisms don't meet the specifications of our nuclear and security experts, there will be no deal. But if we can get this done, and Iran follows through on the framework that our negotiators agreed to, we will be able to resolve one of the greatest threats to our security and to do so peacefully. Given the importance of this issue, I have instructed my negotiators to fully brief Congress and the American people on the substance of the deal. And I welcome a robust debate in the weeks and months to come. I am confident that we can show that this deal is good for the security of the United States, for our allies, and for the world. For the fact is, we only have three options for addressing Iran's nuclear program. First, we can reach a robust and verifiable deal, like this one, and peacefully prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. The second option is we can bomb Iran's nuclear facilities, thereby starting another war in the Middle East and setting back Iran's program by a few years. In other words, setting it back by a fraction of the time that this deal will set it back. Meanwhile, we'd ensure that Iran would race ahead to try and build a bomb. Third, we could pull out of negotiations, try to get other countries to go along and continue sanctions that are currently in place or add additional ones and hope for the best, knowing that every time we have done so, Iran has not capitulated but instead has advanced its program, and that in very short order, the breakout timeline would be eliminated, and a nuclear arms race in the region could be triggered because of that uncertainty. In other words, the third option leads us very quickly back to a decision about whether or not to take military action, because we'd have no idea what was going on inside of Iran. Iran is not going to simply dismantle its program because we demand it to do so. That's not how the world works, and that's not what history shows us. Iran has shown no willingness to eliminate those aspects of their program that they maintain are for peaceful purposes, even in the face of unprecedented sanctions. But should negotiations collapse because we, the United States, rejected what the majority of the world considers a fair deal, what our scientists and nuclear experts suggest would give us confidence that they are not developing a nuclear weapon, it's doubtful that we can even keep our current international sanctions in place. So when you hear the inevitable critics of the deal sound off, ask them a simple question. Do you really think that this verifiable deal, if fully implemented, backed by the world's major powers, is a worse option than the risk of another war in the Middle East? Is it worse than doing what we've done for almost two decades with Iran moving forward with its nuclear program and without robust inspections? I think the answer will be clear. Remember, I have always insisted that I will do what is necessary to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon, and I will. But I also know that a diplomatic solution is the best way to get this done and offers a more comprehensive and lasting solution. It is our best option by far. And while it is always a possibility that Iran may try to cheat on the deal in the future, this framework of inspections and transparency makes it far more likely that we'll know about it if they try to cheat. And I or future presidents will have preserved all of the options that are currently available to deal with it. To the Iranian people, I want to reaffirm what I've said since the beginning of my presidency. We are willing to engage you on the basis of mutual interests and mutual respect. This deal offers the prospect of relief from sanctions that were imposed because of Iran's violation of international law. Since Iran's supreme leader has issued a fatwa against the development of nuclear weapons, this framework gives Iran the opportunity to verify that its program is in fact peaceful. It demonstrates that if Iran complies with its international obligations, then it can fully rejoin the community of nations, thereby fulfilling the extraordinary talent and aspirations of the Iranian people. That would be good for Iran, and it would be good for the world. Of course, this deal alone, even if fully implemented, will not end the deep divisions and mistrust between our two countries. We have a difficult history between us, and our concerns will remain with respect to Iranian behavior so long as Iran continues its sponsorship of terrorism, its support for proxies who destabilize the Middle East, its threats against America's friends and allies, like Israel. So make no mistake, we will remain vigilant in countering those actions and standing with our allies. It's no secret that the Israeli Prime Minister and I don't agree about whether the United States should move forward with a peaceful resolution to the Iranian issue. If, in fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu is looking for the most effective way to ensure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon, this is the best option. And I believe our nuclear experts can confirm that. More importantly, I will be speaking with the Prime Minister today to make clear that there will be no daylight, there is no daylight, when it comes to our support for Israel's security and our concerns about Iran's destabilizing policies and threats towards Israel. And that's why I've directed my national security team to consult closely with the new Israeli government in the coming weeks and months about how we can further strengthen our long-term security cooperation with Israel and make clear our unshakable commitment to Israel's defense. Today, I also spoke with the King of Saudi Arabia to reaffirm our commitment to the security of our partners in the Gulf. And I'm inviting the leaders of the six countries who make up the Gulf Cooperation Council, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and Bahrain, to meet me at Camp David this spring to discuss how we can further strengthen our security cooperation while resolving the multiple conflicts that have caused so much hardship and instability throughout the Middle East. Finally, it's worth remembering that Congress has, on a bipartisan basis, played a critical role in our current Iran policy, helping to shape the sanctions regime that applied so much pressure on Iran and ultimately forced them to the table. In the coming days and weeks, my administration will engage Congress once again about how we can play how it can play a constructive oversight role. I'll begin that effort by speaking to the leaders of the House and Senate today. In those conversations, I will underscore that the issues at stake here are bigger than politics. These are matters of war and peace, and they should be evaluated based on the facts and what is ultimately best for the American people and for our national security. For this is not simply a deal between my administration and Iran. This is a deal between Iran, the United States of America, and the major powers in the world, including some of our closest allies. If Congress kills this deal, not based on expert analysis and without offering any reasonable alternative, then it's the United States that will be blamed for the failure of diplomacy. International unity will collapse, and the path to conflict will widen. The American people understand this, which is why solid majorities support a diplomatic resolution to the Iranian nuclear issue. They understand instinctively the words of President Kennedy, who faced down the far greater threat of communism and said, "Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate." The American people remember that at the height of the Cold War, presidents like Nixon and Reagan struck historic arms control agreements with the Soviet Union, a far more dangerous adversary. Despite the fact that that adversary not only threatened to destroy our country and our way of life, but had the means to do so. Those agreements were not perfect. They did not end all threats, but they made our world safer. A good deal with Iran will do the same. Today, I'd like to express my thanks to our international partners for their steadfastness, their cooperation. I was able to speak earlier today with our close allies, Prime Minister Cameron and President Hollande and Chancellor Merkel, to reaffirm that we stand shoulder to shoulder in this effort. And most of all, on behalf of our nation, I want to express my thanks to our tireless, and I mean tireless, Secretary of State John Kerry and our entire negotiating team. They have worked so hard to make this progress. They represent the best tradition of American diplomacy. Their work, our work, is not yet done, and success is not guaranteed. But we have a historic opportunity to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons in Iran and to do so peacefully, with the international community firmly behind us. We should seize that chance. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
That was President Obama speaking live from the Rose Garden. Iran and six world powers have agreed to key parameters for a preliminary deal involving Tehran's nuclear program following 8 days of talks in Lausanne, Switzerland. The EU foreign policy chief said today this crucial decision will lay the basis for reaching a final agreement by the June 30th deadline. I'm Kim Lewis on the VOA, and we now resume our regular programming.
Africa Rising, Miriam Chimos.
While a South African with no scientific education designed solar cookers and ovens that are remarkably popular all over Africa. Crosby Menzies' product uses heat from the sun to cook food. That reduces the need to cut trees for firewood. Those who use Menzies' solar cookers also can avoid the dangers of pollution created by paraffin stoves. In the fourth part, his renewable energy series, Darren Taylor reports.
Crosby Menzies used to be a marketer in London. The money was good, but his state of mind was bad. The South African wanted to help people live better lives, not sit behind a computer in an office all day, every day. So 11 years ago, Menzies returned to his homeland. Soon afterwards, on a trip to Zambia, he saw a few rudimentary solar cookers. Menzies was convinced they could solve a problem that millions of Africans have, their daily struggle to cook their food without the aid of electricity. He wanted to build his own improved solar cookers, despite not knowing a thing about solar energy.
Guys start talking to me about watts and volts and all these things, and my brain just switches off. I'm not super intelligent by a long way. Which is why I'm like...
Undaunted, Menzies traveled the globe to learn as much as he could about solar technology. For almost a decade, he experimented with various designs of solar cookers until he came up with his own model. It looks like a shiny satellite dish.
If you can imagine, the dish is covered with tinfoil or aluminium. That concentrates all of the sun into one place. And just through that, you can generate enough temperature for cooking. And the bigger the dish,
but instead of distributing signals from outer space to a TV, Menzies' dishes transmit heat from the sun to a center point on the dish, over which food can be cooked. In much the same way as a magnifying glass can be used to concentrate sunlight onto a piece of paper, eventually causing it to burn.
There is a fire point. That's why the company is called Sunfire, because it's exactly like moving fire from the sun and putting it onto your pot. So there is
these high-heat solar cookers are particularly good at frying and boiling food. His successful design allowed Menzies to open his own solar cooker business. He says many people at the time didn't know about the great need for alternative energy in Africa, and so they were convinced that his enterprise would fail.
I was told right at the beginning that running a solar cooker company and making it feasible and financially stable was impossible. And that was, in fact, my inspiration for starting the company.
8 years later, Menzies is the continent's leading supplier of solar cookers. He's now also making solar ovens. They're made of wood and are box-shaped. Reflective foil on top channels sunlight into a chamber, effectively heating it and turning it into an oven. Sunfire solar ovens are good for slower methods of cooking, such as stewing and roasting.
You would actually prepare your lunch in the morning, put it in the solar oven. Come lunchtime, you come back and your lunch is already cooked. They do not get to a temperature that can burn your food. So there's no danger that you're going to come back and it's totally crisp.
Menzies' cookers and ovens now sell in 40 countries in Africa. But he acknowledges that he always has a hard time convincing people that they work.
And it doesn't seem to matter if it is the president of South Africa or a herd boy in Lesotho. It's astonishing. The response is the same. And we've done demonstrations in Germany. We've done demonstrations all over the world. And people are very incredulous that food can actually be cooked with the sun.
He insists that food cooked with solar heat is much healthier than meals prepared using electricity and gas.
Your food is delicious, very succulent. There's a definite change in the way that food tastes when it's cooked with sunlight. So my simple point is that it just tastes better. Every single person that we've ever put out a solar cooker with has come back to us and said, wow, the food is just absolutely amazing.
But Menzies' basic cookers cost $140 each, a price impoverished Africans cannot afford.
The people who generally see the value in the solar cookers are quite often the poorest of the poor. So finance is probably our biggest stumbling block.
Never want to shrink from a challenge. Menzies has set up an NGO to secure funding, so he'll be able to donate solar cookers to selected areas in Africa.
I am still of the mind that solar cookers will become as commonplace as cell phone technologies.
Menzies draws his inspiration from the pervasiveness of cell phones in Africa. Just a few years ago, he says, not many would have predicted this. Now, he says, people in Africa's poorest slums still don't have electricity or decent clothes.
But they have sometimes a better cell phone than you do, and then taking pictures of you as you come to visit their village.
To some, Menzies' ambition may sound impossible to fulfill. But given all he has so far achieved, with no formal education in solar technology, he maintains that his objective is not at all far-fetched. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The role of women in South Sudan is changing. Two women in Juba who defied the odds and turned cultural traditions around when they became auto mechanics and opened their own car repair shop. Mugume Davis Rawakarenji has the story.
Let's go, baby.
Yeah. At the University of Juba Auto Garage, 18-month-old Esther Samuel runs to keep up with her mother like any little children would do. Her day is brightened by not only her mother, but about a dozen clients and other mechanics. Samuel's mother, 26-year-old Elizabeth Jacob, is one of two women auto mechanics in this garage. Her dream was to study and become an engineer, but after completing primary 8 at age 18, her parents told her there were no more funds to support her education, and she was ready to be married off. But Elizabeth had another idea. Through encouragement from her brother, in 2008 she was able to join an auto mechanic school in Yei, where she graduated with a diploma.
First he told me I should go for driving course, and then the course was both driving and mechanic, so I choose them both.
Culture and traditional practices in South Sudan are largely to blame for low levels of women literacy, which is now at about 16%, as opposed 40% for males. In most cases, girls are not allowed to attend school or higher levels of education and are forced to marry by Elizabeth's age or even younger. Typically, parents marry off their girls for a lucrative dowry. Boys' education is seen as far more important than girls' education. So if a family cannot afford to send all their children to school, the boys will be sent to school and the girls will work at home. The other female mechanic working in this garage is 28-year-old Diane Andrew, a single mother who decided to fix cars because she couldn't earn enough from selling tea. Diane and Elizabeth are paid £1,400 per month. Diane uses her money to support herself and her 8-year-old son. Elizabeth has been able to buy a plot of land and hopes to build a house for herself. Joseph Akech James arrives at the garage to have his oil changed. He says the only person he wants to work on his car is Elizabeth, for a good reason.
When you first open here, and then I leave the car first to cool, because it is very hot. Winters get cold, and then up.
Ma hi bishtagal kwayis fi mekanikiya. وطبعاً بالنسبة للمرأة في مجال بتاع الشغل.
James says women mechanics are more careful than men. He says they are also more trustworthy. Women cannot remove your functioning spare parts and replace them with old spare parts, says James. Women are very reliable. And there are other advantages of women playing a profession dominated by men. You can get moral support. Fellow mechanic Jacob Charles helps with Elizabeth's baby when she tries to reach for her mother, who is busy changing oil. Charles says when the mother is busy, they have to try to play with the baby so she doesn't disrupt her work. He says she's like our own, and we think by staying here with us, she may also eventually become a mechanic. Elizabeth Jacob says, despite her full-time job as a mechanic, she still fulfills her other responsibilities as a mother and a housewife.
Yeah, when I wake up in the morning, I first clean my compound and prepare tea for the children, and then I come to work. From there, I go home at 4. to the market and then I go and make food for the children also.
Elizabeth's husband, 44-year-old Samuel Alcangelo, also a mechanic, is aware of the challenges his wife faces each day. Alcangelo says he met Elizabeth here at the garage when she was already a mechanic. He says he knows how demanding the job can be sometimes. He says a woman does have to do all the cooking, so he helps in that way. The United Nations has said women bear the biggest burden of war, as they do in South Sudan's conflict. Whereas men engage in active combat, it is women like Elizabeth who not only take care of their families at home, but support their families by working outside the home, and in so doing, help in nation building. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinji.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a further sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on three more leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabab. The men are Yasin Kilwe, Abdikader Mohammed Abdikader, also known as Ikrima, and Jafar, also known as Amar. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, has control of large areas of southern and central Somalia and is responsible for the death of thousands of Somali citizens, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab is engaged in a campaign of violence, including bombings and suicide attacks, which has killed thousands. In July 2010, it planned and executed a bomb attack in Kampala, Uganda, that killed more than 70 people, including an American citizen. Yasin Kilwe is Al-Shabaab's leader in the Puntland region of Somalia. He pledged his allegiance to Al-Qaeda in February 2012. Abdikader, 34 years old, was born in Kenya of Somali parents. He has coordinated recruitment of Kenyan youth into Al-Shabaab and commanded a force of Kenyan fighters operating in Somalia. He reportedly has medium-length hair, a thick mustache, and is missing three fingers on his left hand. Jafar has served as Abdikader's deputy and reportedly is missing one eye. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy. Submit a tip through the RFJ website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. The United States guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
next on Let's Talk. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing celebrities. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.